This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Flare, a leader in providing actionable cyber threat intelligence to companies and governments around the world.
Josh Boffman currently serves as an analyst at Air University's China Aerospace Studies Institute. His research centers on Chinese People's Liberation Army activity in the cyber and information domain. He guest lectures at the National Defense University and Institute of World Politics on China's cyber strategy and misinformation efforts. Josh previously worked at the National Defense University's College of Information and Cyberspace, the U.S. Air Force Academy, and Tsinghua University in Beijing, where he spent 3 years living in China, working as an editor and journalist on Chinese security issues. We will be right back with a fascinating conversation with Josh Boffman. But first, here's my colleague Michael Morrell with a message about Flare.
The lines between geopolitical risk and cyber risk are blurring. Flare is a next-generation, continuous threat exposure management SaaS platform that equips corporate information security teams with world-class collection and continuous monitoring across dark web cybercrime forums, markets, Telegram channels, and sources of geopolitical risk. Flare sets up in 30 minutes, creates actionable intelligence from hour one, and is used by governments, security teams, and threat intelligence teams around the world. You can try Flare's free trial at their website, flare.io. That's flare.io.
Welcome back. Josh, great to have you on the podcast. Maybe we can start out with you telling our audience a little about Air University and specifically what you work on. I touched on it briefly in the introduction, but maybe you can expand a little bit on that.
Yeah, so Air University, it's located in Maxwell Air Force Base, and it's the Intellectual Leadership Development Center for the Air and Space Forces. So essentially, it's the lead agent for air education, Air Force education. The idea is that we aim to access, train, educate, and develop air and space warfighters. So there are various professional military education programs, but we also focus on research. So that's where China Aerospace Studies Institute, where I work, comes into play. So we are the premier center for the study of China and its aerospace capabilities. The idea that we focus on is advancing strategy, doctrine, operating concepts, capabilities, personnel, training, organization of China's aerospace forces, and civilian and commercial infrastructure that supports them. So we want to better understand decision-making, limitations, opportunities, and challenges that China poses. And it's important to note that everyone at China Aerospace Studies Institute has language capabilities. So if you want to work for CASI, you have to have Mandarin proficiency because we're looking at original documents and doing research and understanding China in that way.
Okay, so let's get to the meat of the discussion today. And you've written on this, and maybe we can tell the audience what this is. Cognitive warfare. So what is it broadly, and what is it in the Chinese context?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is an important topic, and I'm happy to hear various people in Congress and other people starting to talk about this idea. But it's important to really understand cognitive warfare in a cognitive domain. So before we really get into it, there's some things I want to kind of demystify about China. So the idea of the cognitive domain, it originated in the United States DoD report to Congress in 2001 in a document called Network-Centric Warfare. So there, they talked about the cognitive domain. And what's important to note because of this is that, you know, oftentimes we think about China in the sense of, you know, that they're thinking in such unique and different ways that it's hard for us to, in the West, to really comprehend. But in reality, what they often do is look at what the West is doing, what is working, what isn't. They're very pragmatic. For example, they look and saw that cyber and space were becoming more important in warfare. So for them, they created in 2015 with military reform, they created the Strategic Support Force. So this idea of cognitive domain is something they've looked at certainly and what the United States has talked about and what they're doing. So just to kind of emphasize this, you know, you hear about the 100-year marathon, you hear about unrestricted warfare, and these ideas that, you know, China is thinking in such a different way is really not true. They're very pragmatic, and they're looking at strategically what others are doing and applying that to their own case. But now back to, you know, cognitive warfare. You can break it down into the first word, cognition. So what is cognition? So the basic idea of cognition is the process by which people acquire, process, and apply information and knowledge. So you take in information, then you process it, and then you have some form of action, or you do something with that information, whether it be positive, good, is it useful, is it not? So now, with the understanding of cognition, now we talk about cognitive warfare or cognitive domain operations. So if it's this idea of processing and acquiring and applying knowledge, the main target of cognitive warfare then, and what the PLA talks about, is actually the human brain. So everyone here listening today is a potential target. And it's not just at the individual level, but also at a societal level. And the idea here is to focus on looking at weakening and dismantling an enemy's will to fight. What they do, or what you're supposed to do in the cognitive warfare, is to use our own emotions against us. So we all have fears, we all have anxiety, we all have suspicion. And these are used as essentially breakthrough points to create what they call soft kills. You want to create an atmosphere of insecurity, uncertainty, mistrust with the enemy, to create internal frictions and cause decision-making, doubts, and things of that nature. So when we think about warfare, we think about, you might think of, you know, fighter jets or other tangible kinetic forms of warfare. But, you know, what PLA says and what they've said for a very long time is, at the end of the day, it is a contest of human will. So when you're thinking about human will, you're thinking about, you know, where that lies in warfare. You know, the ultimate high ground in which human will is placed is in the cognitive domain, because you are shaping cognition and how people think. One of the things that is interesting, and we'll get into in this podcast, is the use of technology and how technology is now shaping the cognitive domain. We'll get into social media and many other technologies that are current and emerging.
The idea of cognitive warfare, just broadly speaking, is not new. Certainly not, you know, not new in 2001, right? I mean, for as far back as you can go in history, you know that, you know, one adversary tries to affect the way another adversary thinks about a conflict, right? It's just that today, and I'm sort of, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, I don't want you to sort of jump in here. It's just that today you can have a much greater effect because of technology, social media, you know, sort of you name it. Is that what you're sort of getting at? And then when we talk about that, is this now, you know, taking a real front and center place in the way the PRC and the People's Liberation Army, the PLA, think about warfare? Or is this just a fringe concept?
Okay, those are really great questions. Yeah, you know, we're thinking about cognitive warfare. You know, since the beginning of warfare, there has been, you know, this idea of trying to shape cognition. So whether you try to appear stronger than you are, or you try to use deception, or you try to do various means to shape the cognition of your adversary. These are things that are happening since the very beginning of conflict. Obviously, you know, you think about, you know, with dropping pamphlets and things like that. But now, today, with technology, and we're going to get into that more, things are changing in a way that is really completely changing the landscape of the cognitive domain. And in your question, is it fringe? Is it something that, you know, some people are talking about, but not really adopted in the current PLA? It absolutely is not fringe. It is something that is very mainstream, is being written about more and more each day, and we get to learn more about how they're thinking about it. and the PLA is focused on it. But also, just to note about cognitive domain, as I mentioned before, you know, all of us are involved. We all have brains. We all have that battle space in between our ears. It's not just the PLA. It is, they talk about whole of government and whole of society. So, and we'll get more into this as we go forward, but it is not something that is just contained within the military. It's something that is much broader, and something that the Chinese Communist Party understands is if they can win the cognitive domain, they can win conflicts.
So social media, we sort of touched on here, it is an accelerator, right? It allows you to reach a lot more people. And so I gather from your writings that China now sees this as a domain, much like air, sea, space, right? This is a warfare domain, and that's the way they're going to approach it. Is that the way you see it?
Yeah, absolutely. They in various writings, they put social media, or they put, excuse me, cognitive domain as equal to those other domains that you speak of. And then when we're talking about social media, this is the main battlefield in which you can shape cognition. If you look at the average user using social media, something like 2.5 hours a day, if you add all of that up over a lifespan, that's something like 5.5 years of your life on social media. So the PLA is, and other organizations within the Chinese Communist Party are writing more and more about how social media can be used in the cognitive domain, in cognitive warfare, and how to shape the minds of their adversary and those that they want to, as well as, and we'll get into this as well, their own people.
So Josh, in your writing about the PLA, you call out sort of four social media tactics, or the PLA does. So I thought maybe we could go through them and you could give some examples, and we'll just sort of step through them.
Yeah,
these seem
absolutely
sort of uniquely sort of Chinese naming conventions. The first one they call information disturbance. So can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, sure. And I think it is interesting that they have given us some strategic insights into social media. So information disturbance. This idea here is essentially mainstream Chinese news sources like Global Times, Xinhua, CGTN, putting out official narrative perspectives from the Chinese Communist Party. So anything that you see like coming out from Global Times or Xinhua or these sorts of things is something that would be in this information disturbance. An example, one that they've pushed a narrative more and more in recent years, is that there is a Western decline while China is on the rise. And they push that throughout their official channels. They push that all the time. They point out, you know, look at the crime that's happening in the United States. Look at the bad things. We actually, what's interesting is they say they are the best democracy in the world. They say that they're a democracy, that they understand the needs of each individual citizen in China better than the United States and the West does. So that is a narrative in sort of the information disturbance that's official. Another example, going back farther, Deng Xiaoping, this idea of hiding brightness, nourishing obscurity, this sort of idea of we're peacefully rising. You know, this narrative really shaped policy over many years. And then finally, they do look at, you know, what was dubbed the Twitter wars in 2014 between Israel and Palestine, in the way that Palestine was able to shape the narrative in certain ways to be favorable to them.
Okay. Well, you know, maybe they know the needs of their citizens better because they spy on all of them.
Absolutely.
Second tactic is something they call discourse competition.
Yes. So discourse competition is where we get a little more interesting, because it's not so direct. You know, if you see something from, you know, CGTN, oftentimes, you know, it's marked, hey, this is from the Chinese Communist Party, etc. But discourse competition is much more subtle. And it's not something that you do over 1 or 2 days. It's something that you shape cognition over a period of time. So, you know, examples you can think about is, you know, you might have know, we have political parties in the United States, and you might push one to more extreme side or the other, or you might see groups that hate the United States, for example, and pushing that narrative, building those sort of ideas, or maybe that democracy doesn't work in the United States, or that there's issues with the election system. These sorts of bias that you can, their emotions and their ideas that people maybe cling to some degree, but you're pushing them farther and farther into what I love this term is what China calls a cognitive cocoon. So the goal of this discourse competition is to create essentially this cocoon in which you only listen to the narrative bias that you've become emotionally attached to. And if there's something exterior that is factual, you won't even listen to it because you're stuck in this cocoon. And I mentioned also thinking about this idea with the Chinese people themselves. So what the Chinese Communist Party does with the Chinese citizens is they try to create a cognitive cocoon in which they control all the information. They want a one China story to be told and for each citizen to understand that. And they you have like Xi Jinping thought and things like that they must learn from kindergarten on. And that's the idea of building this, you know, red Chinese Communist Party branded cocoon for their own people as well. So they're trying to build different cocoons abroad, but also they're doing the same thing in their own country.
Yeah, this one sounds a lot like, you know, what we've seen throughout other communist regime, you know, the Soviet Union, right? They were sort of, you know, wanted their people to believe one thing and one thing only. Yeah, and it was probably easier then because there wasn't as many avenues of information, but it sounds like a sort of a communist tactic. Third, something they call public opinion blackout. What does that mean?
Right. So if you think about, you know, what you gravitate to when you're looking at social media or news or something like that, if you see the same narrative over and over again, the same information, the idea here is that you're flooding, you know, for example, if you're flooding, you know, positive things about the Chinese Communist Party or some narrative that you want to push, the counter to that you don't see because there's 1,000 posts to one, you know, post that would be counter to that. So you're basically, you can use bots, you can use other methods to really flood, you know, like, hey, this side is bad, our side is good. This actually gets into like sort of when we're talking about good versus bad, one of the operational concepts they talk about is competing for moral jurisprudence. So the idea that you are on the side of good. China always talks about being, you know, believers in peace, and the West is the one that's causing chaos and sowing, you know, violence throughout the world, and that they're, you know, they have the moral high ground. But the basic idea, though, again, public opinion blackout is that you dominate the information and no one sees the counter to it, if you can. And they do talk about how the United States is able to do this with their own platform, the social media and things like that to a degree, but there's something that they want to push for more in the future.
And then the last one, which I don't know, maybe it's the most aggressive one, I guess, is what they call block information.
Yeah, blocking information, I think, would be more applied in a conflict or war type scenario. The idea here is to conduct technical attacks, blockades, even physical destruction of information communication channels. So an extreme example, like knocking down, you know, Facebook or knocking down certain people from being able to communicate using social media. The basic idea is that you just, if you have an adversary's narrative, you make it so that they can't disseminate that information. And that would be certainly the most aggressive. It would be we are in a more serious war-type scenario, I think, would be used for that.
So, Josh, the first three that we talked about, information disturbance, discourse competition, public opinion blackout, do you see those things coexisting, or are they an escalatory ladder? Certainly the last one, you know, block information is, or are all those three in play all the time?
All those those first three would be in play all the time. You're always going to have official channels with official narratives coming from Global Times about how great China's economy is doing, how terrible the West is, et cetera, et cetera. You're always going to try to shape cognition in a more subtle way with discourse competition. In terms of public opinion blackout, that is easier said than done to some degree, but it's something that they, you know, they have so many bots and they have sophistication to kind of push certain narratives. But all three are always in play, and they're all different means to shape cognition, to shape the narrative using the social media platforms.
So that public opinion blackout that seems like something that is pretty straightforward if you control the internet in your country.
Yep, that makes it much easier and becoming more and more sophisticated. I mean, if just as a side note here, we talk about, you know, how bad, you know, we're talking about legislation with TikTok and should we have TikTok? But there is an app worse than TikTok. And some of your listeners may be familiar with it. It's WeChat. WeChat is what most in China use for texting, for looking at news, or even paying for items. It's kind of a one-stop shop for everything that they do. But the Chinese Communist Party is able to very easily look at, even when you're typing, what you're typing. If you delete it, they have it. They have all your biometric data. They have pretty much everything that you can imagine about you. And if you get out of line, you know, they can surgically come in and cut you out. And if you don't have WeChat, it becomes a problem because that's how everyone communicates. And that's how everyone generally often pays for things now and everything else. So you become a social pariah if you step out of line.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Josh Boffman.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
Josh, you also mentioned something else in a note to me called language confrontation.
Yes.
So, what is that?
Yeah. So when we're talking about the cognitive domain, language is so important. The language that we use, the words that we use really matter. So I want to give an example with one word, reunification. Reunification is something you may hear in different contexts. But the idea of reunification, if you were to do a quick Google image search, would have a mother and a child coming back together. So this idea of reunification is one that is very positive and something that, how could you deny a mother and child coming together? So we have this word. Now let's put it into the context of our discussion, put it into a phrase. This idea of China's reunification with Taiwan. Probably heard that a lot. Xi Jinping recently said in a speech that, you know, China will be reunified with Taiwan. But the idea of, reunification, you know, under Chinese Communist Party, like I said, it's this undeniable thing coming back from the motherland. But in reality, reunification is not the word that we should be using. Taiwan was never part of the People's Republic of China. Their claims, you know, that it's, you know, just part of, you know, it's just a territory that they own is incorrect. Even going back historically, going back to the Qing Dynasty, Taiwan was more part of Qing Dynasty nominally than effectively. And then under the Japanese rule, you see this growing Taiwanese identity. And now, today, most people in Taiwan identify first and only as Taiwanese, not Taiwanese and Chinese. So the idea that China, that Taiwan is simply part of China and that they're reunifying this mother and this wayward child coming back together is incorrect. But what we do in the West is we reiterate that language. We say reunification very often. Maybe you don't think about it, but it is subtle, and it's something that is very powerful. There's actually recently a Chinese diplomat came to New York, and he was like, well, people in the United States don't even know where Taiwan is. And if you have this very positive word, reunification, maybe some people that are not educated will just think, hey, you know, why wouldn't we want reunification? Reunification is a good thing, right? And then another last point is, okay, English, reunification. But China isn't just adept at using words like reunification, you know, using the English language. They also are in nations all over the world using their own language. Actually, Freedom House did a report on Beijing media global influence and looked at how they use language and take over media outlets to use the narratives and language of that nation or that community effectively to create certain narratives and certain mindset that you might not even be aware of.
So, Josh, I know we've been focusing here on social media and its role in this cognitive warfare arena, but certainly there are other emerging technologies that you know would have a role. Can you just talk a little bit about that and maybe how the PRC or the People's Liberation Army think about those?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot. This is a great question because there's a lot of very exciting, interesting things going on. They look at technology and the mind. Tech nexus is something that's critically important when we're talking about cognitive domain strategy. So the first one, and one that you've probably been reading about in various contexts, is generative AI. You may have used ChatGPT to help you write an email or what have you. China views generative AI as something that is critically useful to cognitive domain warfare. So when we think about the uses of generative AI, one of the things that they always mention is, you know, this enhancing human-machine interaction. And with that, you're able to do a lot of different things. So when we're talking about a cognitive domain operations or an attack offensively, you can now, using generative AI, you can take the data of an individual like yourself, look at everything you've ever said, look at everything you've ever written, look at everything you've ever done, and then create a message directed towards you specifically that would create, potentially a emotional reaction. And a funny story here, because we've been talking about one of my recent articles that we had in Defense One, I actually got a message directed towards me that seemed to have a lot of information that I believe was potentially using generative AI. So I got an email, very angry email, criticizing the article and saying all the issues. So, you know, the ability to go from, you know, maybe you have 10,000 people, not native English speakers, trying to write messages to individuals or social media posts or what have you. Now generative AI can create these custom, beautifully written, perfect English or whatever language they're using to create specific narratives. And within this space, I've read about recently, just to emphasize, this idea of this technology called psych bots. So again, what you do is you take everything someone's written, maybe someone's prolific, they've done a lot of different things, they're a public figure, and you can create a psych bot that mimics that person. So there was actually an example with Martin Seligman, who is an American psychologist, and they created a bot that is quite accurate, actually, in terms of mimicking his abilities, his kind of like what he would say and things like that. So there's so much that you could do to create narratives, to shoot out information using generative AI. And moving forward, 2024, something you're going to hear probably more, you've heard probably large language models. But now we're at what they're doing, what's happening is an adding modalities to large language models. So what we refer to as large multimodal models. So instead of, hey, you know, I'm going to put some text in to the, you know, maybe a ChatGPT or what have you, you can add video, you can add audio, and you can, you know, request, hey, I want text, I want video, I want photos. So there's different modalities of information that you can use that will enhance that capability. Moving forward with other technology, though, it's something that I think needs to be noted is the cognitive effects of cyber, offensive cyber warfare. So you may have heard of Volt Typhoon, which we're learning more about now, but it hit water utilities in Hawaii, at least one oil and gas pipeline, and they attempted to hit the Texas power grid. And one of the things that is actually said in our own U.S. national cybersecurity strategy about China is that with attacks like this, they're trying to create societal chaos and impair decision-making around a crisis. So when we're thinking about cyber, it does, you know, a cyber attack can have significant cognitive effects where you might not know what's going on. You might feel overwhelmed if your power grid's out. So I do see in the future, and we'll get more into Taiwan, that these type of attacks will be utilized to disrupt and cause confusion. Moving quickly to a few other technologies, and we're talking about offensive, but cognitive domain also has defensive. So you want to be able to attack your adversary, but then you also want to protect your own soldiers in people's minds. So obviously, you know, we talked about ideology. They're using technology in China now. They have an app called Study Xi Strong Country, where it was the biggest app when it came out. And basically, people can be monitored and forced, essentially, to make sure that they're doing their daily study of Xi Jinping thought. So they're using technology to fortify the minds of the people in China so that they're making sure that they're studying well, is what they talk about. Moving forward, a couple other things. There's also wearable technology that's being implemented in the PLA to monitor the physiological data, kind of understand what's going on in the mental state of the soldiers at any given time. And this is part of a broader system called Intelligent Psychological Monitoring System. They also use virtual reality therapy. So they gave an example of a soldier who was always stressed out when he was going through training, so they decided to put him through VR therapy, and that was able to, over time, help him cope with stress, and now, at least in the story, he's able to do training and excel in what he's doing, rather than not being able to do that. And those are things, just to mention, you know, wearable technology, using virtual reality in different ways like this, these are things the United States is doing as well. So again, I don't want it to be like, you know, China's doing all this, but what are we doing? We're doing a lot as well in this field. Back to generative AI too. When we're talking about decision making, we're talking about what they say in many writings. You know, we hear about fog of war. They also talk about cognitive fog, kind of a similar concept. Generative AI will also play a role in helping decision making. If you have an understanding of what's going on, you can use generative AI to kind of look at different decisions that might be effective going forward. You know, you can say, okay, hey, ChatGPT, or ChatGPT, what's the best outcome or what's the best options? And it might give you three different ideas. That being said, just as a caveat, China does believe in technology and innovation as being very important, but they also talk about not over-reliance on things like generative AI is a problem. If you don't have a human in the loop, you completely blindly trust, you know, things coming from generative AI and other technologies, they say that you're letting the devil in. So there is perhaps some misconceptions that China is just all on board and moving forward, but they are also looking at the dangers of that, and there has been legislation and the things that are being passed as they move forward. And then a few other things they have for the soldiers. They're developing augmented reality helmets to give them better battlefield awareness. They're also looking at digital twin technology. So digital twin, very quickly, you have, you know, a physical object like your phone. There's also a digital version of that. But in the future, they're talking about creating a digital twin of the entire battlefield where you have all the components, you understand what's going on, and you can, using in augmenting with generative AI, you can have a better understanding of what is the best action, what is actually happening on the ground at any given point. But that is moving forward further. And then another interesting thing is, and this is going to be even bigger in 2024 and beyond, something we got to talk about, is brain-computer interface. So China's talking about it. There's been a lot of advancements and continuing to be advancements. So there are already technologies that are being developed, neural interface technology, where you imagine you click a mouse. Before you click that mouse, there's things happening in your mind that put signals through your body that you then click the mouse. Well, with this interface, you can click, you can swipe, you can do all these different things just by thinking them. So that is something that they're talking about in the military military context as well. They talk about seamless cognitive cooperation with machines, that you don't even need to be physically on the battlefield. They'll have the seamless link in the future. So that is something that is actually going to be moving faster than maybe some expect. We're understanding brain waves much more sophisticated levels, and that will continue to move to the future. And then finally, the last thing is the future of the internet. So for a very long time, China's they have their own, they have internet as well, but it's been on the terms of the West. The West created the internet, and they have been kind of a follower of that. But what they look for into the future is, and you may have heard this, the metaverse, and this more immersive, using all of your senses, internet that of the future. That is something that they're looking at. And just very quickly, and we can get more into it if you like, on the metaverse, but in the context of the cognitive domain. Imagine, right now, the internet, you might watch a video, you might look at text, but imagine being, within the internet, being kind of immersed in it more. We're using more of your senses, using more of emotions, perhaps, are evolved. China's looking at that as a potentially a greater ability to shape cognition, because there is more more immersion. It's less passive. It's more creating content, creating your own, reality in a sense. And that is something that if they can go, if they can be a leader in, they can have an incredible amount of power there.
So Josh, so that's a big sphere of things. Let me, in the few minutes we have left, let me just ask you a couple questions. Have you seen the intensity of this sort of cognitive warfare change over the last few years? Do you have a sense of impact? You can talk about it so broadly, or in the context of Taiwan. We just had an election in Taiwan. It didn't go the way the PRC, I think, had wanted it to go. So there may be an escalation cycle coming there. But just broadly, have you just sort of seen this sort of intensity changing over the last few years?
Well, I think absolutely. I think the intensity has changed, partly because technology has changed, but also, under Xi Jinping, he's seen the power of social media, of shaping cognition, of all the things that we're talking about. And it's been more professionalized. You have, under Strategic Support Force, for example, you have psychological warfare as an emphasis. So the idea has really grown. And when we're talking about Taiwan, so yes, you're right. They're not happy about the election, but what is going on with Taiwan? Taiwan, if you were to look at one country and try to kind of understand, what's going on with cognitive domain warfare and the PRC, is a very good example. Cognitive warfare is being deployed at the most highest levels in the world is Taiwan. Obviously, we're talking about this idea of, quote, reunification, although we should not use reunification. Beijing wants to compel Taipei to unify, in their words. And obviously, Taiwanese people have been resilient. They have created their own identity. But with the Taiwan piece, there is something I have to emphasize. It's not just about Taiwan and the mental cognition of the Taiwanese people. It also involves the United States. So if they can create an atmosphere in which they don't, in which they, Taiwanese people think that the United States is not going to support Taiwan, or maybe is losing, you know, the support, the backing that they've had in the past, that could directly attack the will of the people of Taiwan and be catastrophic. So that is something that we need to continue to emphasize our support for Taiwan, because if we stop that, or if we push policies that would indicate otherwise, that will directly impact Taiwan. And, you know, we lose the cognitive domain, we lose the war.
So Josh, that leads me to, I guess, maybe the last question, and it's a bit the big question, and that's, you know, how do you counter cognitive warfare in a free and open society where you just can't, you just don't shut off the channels, right?
Right. I think that is a great question and something that I continue, you know, keeps me up at night, I guess you could say. But I think I love the word that you, a couple words that you use, free and open society. I think that that is something that we can say is an advantage. So let me explain. China has what I would consider an information problem, while we have a misinformation problem. So what that means is China is constantly trying to make sure that their story is told correctly, that only one specific Chinese Communist Party narrative is approved. While we in the West, in the United States, have a more open internet with information. So there is danger, but there also is opportunity. Now with that, one of the things that we have to think about and what we need to better do, I think, is education in terms of consuming media, in terms of consuming social media. I think that, you know, we improve, we have, you know, K through 12 education where we have critical thinking. Because I do believe that, you know, China tries to censor everything. We can't, in the United States, try to copy that modality of we just have to censor everything. If it's something we don't agree with, censor it. That is not how we should address this issue. We should equip people with the ability to think critically and discern what is and isn't true. And, you know, from a very young age, have kids look at multiple sources of information, not just the headline, and really do their own to try to, you know, educate themselves. And as well as, you know, looking at the technological side, there's also that component too, as we continue to innovate and move forward as well.
Josh, thanks. That was a really thought-provoking discussion and on a topic that I just, you know, not very many people have been focused on. So thank you.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
That was Josh Boffman. I'm Andy Macritas. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters. And you can always reach us at intelligencematterspod@gmail.com.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.